Thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. I am Mustafa Sharif, an urban planner, and you're more than welcome to join my big journey of exploring the making of smarter and more livable cities. Please don't forget to follow Urbanistica on the different social media platforms, and also let's connect on LinkedIn. Big thanks to Urbanistica podcast partner, AFRI. AFRI is an international engineering and design company providing sustainable solutions in the fields of energy, industry, and infrastructure. Are you ready for a new episode? Let's go for it. Hello, and thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. Today we have a new story. We have an amazing storyteller. I have the pleasure to welcome you, Jens, to Urbanistica podcast. Hello and welcome.
Hello, welcome to everyone, and thank you, Mustafa, to invite me.
You're going to be our storyteller, so we start with you. How would you like to introduce yourself to our listener?
Well, technically speaking, I'm an urban planner, and I'm also trained as an architect and engineer, and I think a lot of them have passed or been interviewed before in Urbanistica. I would say, like, of course, when you're in the practice, you also start like revisiting your own profession and seeing like what's your role to play and where can you add on new insights. And I feel more and more like that I and others in our field, we have to somehow be like spatial diplomats. And I mean like that space is so important and it's very much in scarcity because we cannot just keep on expanding space. But of course, a lot of demands are in the space and also a lot of vulnerability questions and priorities have to be made. And so I think we are very much into like how we can optimize the use of space, that it becomes places. And that's, of course, also like the big motto of placemaking, but also sometimes like to really work with people that are actually in their profession or their life not dealing with space, but also like making them understand that space is very important and how also what they are doing can be supported by a good design and management of the little space that we have, but really to work around collective uses and collective meaning.
Exactly. And like, how did everything started in your case, like that you start to work with the architecture and planning and caring about this topic?
Well, in my case, I was first an architect and I did some buildings, and I was fortunate as a very young architect to be able to do a public building. I won a competition as many people, you know, like you do the competitions. It was very nice to have a public assignment. It was a student restaurant actually for the university. So it was also on a campus where I used to come a lot. So it was really like a place that I was very recognizable. And so it brings you immediately into like this question of like, okay, is this about the building? Is it rather also about accommodating people that are growing up, have to meet each other, doing homework together, trying to also work on collaborative works at university. So I found that very interesting. And then I started immediately thinking about urban planning. That's really something that is, for me, more interesting to really think about not just the building side, but also like how does a university work? How does a campus work? How do young people get trained for the future? So that's how I went to do urban planning. But then for a long time, I have to also admit, and we still were, I think that I was also graduate in the time that actually there was not so much discussion around that architecture was for communities, like was more like assignments were like you had to design a museum or you did, okay, some social housing eventually, but it was not really like so much around placemaking. It was only when I had the opportunity 10 years ago to work with UNICEF that then I felt like this is really like a mirror for me, like because you're suddenly in a environment that of professionals, very highly professional people, very dedicated human rights activists that work for the best for children, and they asked me if I could support them in developing an urban program.
Okay.
Which is a large word, a heavy word.
Yeah.
But it was actually in the context of the Habitat 3 conference in 2015, also with the new SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, where you had a specific goal dealing with cities and community, and where there's also a lot of SDGs that are really emphasizing the importance of environment, environmental dimensions to make progress. And that you felt as an urban planner, like, okay, this is an interesting moment in the, I would say, in the global realm to speak about urbanization. And whereas urban planners and architects, they could say like, yeah, urbanization is actually the thing that's really our domain. You feel like there's this huge global arena of people that are working not on the built environment and not on cities, but then see suddenly this context of urbanization that is so crucial to deal with, to actually be able to deliver on their core business. And then in the case of UNICEF, to really deliver on the prosperity and the children's rights in general. And that was interesting because then you felt like, okay, you have to really understand as an urban planner what you can be as an added value as a technical person for people that work with children. So they don't have a design assignment. They don't ask necessarily directly infrastructure. Of course, they need also infrastructure for schools for children, but that's not their core mandate. They want to have general prosperity for children, and especially the most deprived. And that was a moment very interesting to actually think also about the core about what urban planning is about, because urban planning, if you look back, it's really about ensuring health for everyone or ensuring safety for everyone. And then particularly that lens of children makes it very, very, very compelling, because it forces you to see to the most vulnerable, the most promising. I mean, they are the future generation, so they need really the support of urban planners. If we can design cities for children and with children, then these cities will be future-proofed in a way. So that was, I found it very interesting to actually feel like very small in an organization, because it's not an organization that has urban planners, but to feel like, okay, well, how can you actually determine what urban planners should be dealing with more in the future? And I'm happy to see that nowadays, I think it's really something on the agenda. A lot of urban planners think about it, but then also to see like, how can you empower such a big organization as UNICEF to think more about the connection between the built environment and children, which was not really so clear for them at the moment. When I joined them in 2015, and so it was also bringing up this importance of like public spaces are important for children, or mobility systems actually are very important for children, that they can also walk independently and safely to their schools, and to also gain trust to be in a city in a socially safe environment, but also about like all the health issues that are being challenged when you see to all the aspects of air pollution or pollutions in general, where children are also most vulnerable. And so that's very interesting to see that then as a built environment specialist, you can actually make this connection between, okay, actually what are built environment challenges and what are the ones that are particularly challenging for children, and where UNICEF could of course use its unique voice of advocacy and strength of having a lot of programs on the ground in a lot of cities and countries.
Yeah, but when it comes, how to say, because a lot of stakeholders should be involved when it comes to making cities for children, right? It's
yes.
Not only about like UNICEF or urban planners or schools. So how do we bring these stakeholders together?
Well, I think that's also something where we could learn from in both ways. Like I found UNICEF, and it is an organization, and actually it's also typically for organizations where people work with a profile that look at communities that are actually seeing at stakeholders as like that's where you start the process. Whereas I think in our profession, traditionally, you would say like, okay, you will reach out to stakeholders if you've already a very, very precise idea about things and that you go to a public hearing, for example, to get an approval. I think that's where the strength is of like looking at stakeholder engagement in the beginning, like really be very trustful that that it's good to not know anything and to actually ask everybody around the table, but play your role as experts, that you can formulate the questions, that you can actually interact on the questions, that you can, of course, also come up with design solutions that are universal, that are compelling, that are inspiring everybody to build a common agenda. And so I think that's very important to have stakeholders involved from the beginning, so that they do a kind of a system analysis or landscape analysis, and that helps you actually to understand better the issues that are at stake, and that already brings a kind of coalition together that can only grow.
Yeah, like more perspective about the topic.
Yes.
Mm. So also there's like another interesting program that I love to explore with you, and it's like a Save and Sound program.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. So tell me first about the background of creating this program.
Yes. So actually, the Save and Sound Cities program is it's funded by the Fondation Botnar, which is a very interesting foundation that has it has a long tradition working on road safety, and in particularly in Romania and some countries, but then has actually said like, okay, we want to take a step back, and we want to actually see like what are now the big challenges of today. What's where we as a foundation with our approach that can be innovative, like testing the ground, really going a bit crossing the lines of what you usually do as a donor, I would say. And they said like, okay, the challenges are at one point there's a lot of young people, so they want to focus on youth. They see this as they are the game changers. They are the ones that also have to be supported, because there's many in many countries and cities there's a lot of young people, but they don't necessarily are supported, and they don't have specific interesting work, or they are not very familiar with how the system of a city works. So that's for them very important. Secondly, technology. They have they feel like that's something that we have to embrace, and we have to also see where we test ground to use technology to actually empower young people. And thirdly, of course, cities. They see like that's our testing ground. And so they asked me if I could work with them on designing a program that is dealing with safety of young people. And so the first thing we did that was very nice is like bringing people together. And so that's actually already like not really knowing everything, but bringing people together from organizations that are working more or less globally, but also people that really are working on the ground, and to bring them together and actually to have like a discussion for 2 days, where we brought in like some fire starters, you know, people that have a project to explain, and to actually create a kind of common agenda, and to say like, okay, the program could be about this and maybe not about another topic. And so that was a starting point then for in designing the program together with a set of global entities that would really be part of the program. And these global entities are, at the end, Global Infrastructure Basel Foundation. So they are really managing the project together with ICLE, which is a city network. A city network that's having a lot of member cities, and they focus on sustainability. And then there's also a third party, is the World Resource Institute, and it's another known organization based in Washington, and that also works in a lot of countries in the world on sustainability issues. And so now we are in that second year, and in the design phase, what was very important is to look at, like, okay, safety, it's very complex, actually. It's very difficult to define safety. So the objective of the program is also to actually go through a cycle of system understanding, testing, innovating, scaling, and then system change. And actually, these, of course, are words that are still very general, but it also allows then to step in the first place youth organization of selected cities to actually do that exercise themselves. And so we have selected cities. In the first year, we have selected two cities, Envigado in Colombia and Bio in Indonesia. And so they have gone through a round of this system understanding and to actually define for themselves what are the safety issues in our cities, what can we do about it. And already putting this question on the table has, interestingly enough, already helped that youth organizations and youth individuals are talking with the city council, which is actually something, if you think about it, it's not obvious. And actually, it also identifies a problem that the young people that will be the citizens that can vote, or that will be the mayor maybe one day, they, although they have had basic trainings in a technical field, it's not for granted that there's moments in your young life that you actually are able to understand how a city works. And of course, you don't have to agree with how the city works, because of course there's a lot of issues you want to change, but you have to also be able to understand and also have the comfort to talk with local authorities about issues, about things that go wrong in the realm of safety. And also the other way around, cities, they admit that they have difficulties to actually set up participatory projects with young people, because it's a group that is not so easy to grasp. They are not children with their parents, for example, or there's not necessarily children that go to a school and that you can work with the school. So that's also something that for cities is very interesting to work through that program, how they can work with young people more.
Mm-hmm. And like this program, is it open to all the cities, or no? It's like only the cities who are part of the network. Like, so how can cities be part of this program?
So every year there is a call. So we had now the second call, and we've selected four more cities, which are two in the Philippines, which is Baigo and Naiga. And in Ecuador, we have selected Ambato and Cuenca. And the selection process is open, but the filter, I would say, is that we want to feel that there's a youth organization together with a city, with a local authority, that make a very good proposal. And that we feel like there's already a kind of alignment and a will to work together towards solutions. So there will be another call next year.
Awesome.
And it will be good to keep you posted. And in general, everybody who's in that area of urban development, placemaking, to be updated on that.
Yeah. Do they get a financial support, or only like supervisors from the program?
They get both. So they get financial support, but I think most valuable is the support of the program. So the global partners, and they have resources and that can be interesting. For example, ICLE, they have the network with the cities. They can really encourage the cities to engage. They can also help them how to make surveys, etc. There's also a monitoring and evaluation framework that has been set up, which is also very interesting, that we really wanted to have from the beginning a very clear evaluation framework that we want to see in. Hopefully the program can have 10 years as a horizon, and to see like what are the results of that program. And then we, my team, what we give is like support on placemaking. And that we feel like youth organizations would not always see immediately the link between the issues that they see with their youth members, the connection with the built environment or the specific location where they live and gather. So we try to also support them on that, and also do like a placemaking course with best practices from all over the world.
But how can like placemaking make a change in the system for the youth?
It's a good question, because I also thought like, I found it interesting, and I find it also challenging that the program would not like explicitly be about placemaking, but that it should be embedded in the whole process. And actually, if you look at placemaking, then actually it's also kind of starting with a system analysis, bringing people on board that start doing a first project. That project creates more discussion. That could be like confrontations in a more like challenging way, but can also be like inspiring people to do more. And then you feel like there's a moment that you feel like this project that has changed space into a place, and where suddenly there's communities caring about that, this needs like an uptake in the local authorities programs, whether it's like more like a clear identification of who's accountable in a city for this kind of projects, or could it be about this kind of projects that are all scattered over the city should have a decent investment and a management plan. And so actually it's a bit the same. You feel like, of course, after 2 years, it's too soon to say, but you see already like projects that have been identified and that are now being in a process of implementation, that there is going to be an upscale phase. And that is, I think, a lot about what placemaking is, that placemaking is also like not like a result on its own. It's also like trying to bring people together, also like initiating again that appreciation of the very little space we have in cities to really turn them into places where people gather and define actually the future of their city together.
And can you share with us like some of these pilot projects more like in details, what is going on and how is it going and so on? Because as you told me, like 10 years is like a long term when like usually programs, they don't have this kind of really really long term of projects and collaboration. So this is interesting that 10 years.
That's also why I thought this is really a fantastic opportunity to try to think on that long term. And adding to that, before I forget, we also said we need like a research track, which is exactly also like putting into question like how can we make sure that we don't only analyze the project and monitor and evaluate how it goes, but also just seeing like it's interesting to do research on the topic of safe cities and young people, and to also see like where there's links with academic literature. Maybe we can influence also that there's more academic research to be done with that. And that's where we were able to also bring in Placemaking X. You know, the organization that's a bit the umbrella. And so there's a lot of people now that are used to work on placemaking or write or research on placemaking that are somehow involved, and that can be interesting to really create a research component about like better understanding what placemaking is, what it can mean for safety. But coming back to your question, like an example of a project, what I think is very interesting is that in Bandung, one of the first steps that youth organizations did was training young people in how they can map with an online device where safety issues happen in their city. And of course, this is, you would say, this is qualitative data, but it's very interesting because it can complement like quantitative data that a city would have. But you know, like quantitative data is also often very limited or narrow-minded. It would be about maybe road safety accidents that have been reported to the police or some complaints that have been reported to the police. So this is very interesting to already make a map with young people that, of course, they're very tech savvy. They're all always with apps, to really learn them also to put it in an app that now is still online and that you can see growing. And that gives a bit of an idea where the hotspots are, where a lot of young people are, where the places are where that people care about, but also the places where people say like these are missed opportunities or that's where we don't feel very safe. So that was a very first step. And then based on that, there has been a hackathon with young people to think about, okay, what could be ideas as solutions for these places. And there was a great idea of a group of young people. It's called Rhino, R-H-I-N-O, and it's also on the website. So the website, you will see, there's actually, what I'm saying, it's all on the website. It's also, there's blogs and there's some documentation about this project, where they have identified spaces under a flyover, which is a very, I would say, a typical Asian, but actually it's a typical nowadays situation, unfortunately, of a lot of cities that have been growing very fast, where you see that actually the non-built spaces are spaces that somehow are could be having a better use, and that are identified by young people as places that could change. And now it's this places under the flyovers, there's often like parking lots or places where there's a lot of insecurity. And so they said like these are places that are very close to our dense residential areas, and where we would propose to make sport and recreation areas for the community. And of course they see themselves mostly as beneficial for that, to have access to sports. They've also proposed to put like big screens where they can watch together to movies or sport games. And so that's a project that really has been taken up by the city. And you can already feel like this is a project that is very exemplary for what kind of spaces you find in that city. So you can imagine that that's a typical project that can be scaled, and that can be scaled under a lot of other places, flyovers. Of course, you can put on into question also that the flyovers, they're not a good thing, but it's also reality nowadays that there's these places are there, and they could be having much more value for communities. So that's a very nice project, I think, and I'm really looking forward how this plays out more as something that changes the system in that city.
But if we go back to this 10 years, so how is the journey looks like? Because they did the let's say the research and then the collaboration and then the devices and the mapping and then the hackathon. There is a proposal. What is coming if you put us if you show us like a kind of activities and timeline? What is like next?
So, well, it's a good question. I think we have to analyze every year how this. New, it's a pilot. We're now in the piloting phase. It's the second year, and actually, you see in cities that have started last year, it's now the second year. So these projects are still like small projects if you compare on the city scale, but these projects they create that trust or relationship between youth organizations, their community. And the cities, the local authorities. So logically, the support now or the evaluation should lead to like, how can we support the cities to do more of this kind of projects? And it's true that it's going to be also a question of like, how do you finance this? And to look at like, how can we develop advocacy around like that? These are places where you really have a guarantee that there's more safety, because at one time physically there's more safety, but also people care about this. It's a very important aspect of safety in cities, that people really feel recognized. This is the place that I own with my community. This is an idea of young people, so they feel like confident that they are appreciated in that city. And so we will have to look at how we can support the cities to scale this kind of projects in the future, and also look at strengthening like how cities like Bandung, how they more like structurally can look at participation with young people, of course, also.
Mm-hmm. And Jens, when you mention like scale up, do you mean like scale the same how to say proposal and implementing it like different places, different cities, or you mean like scaling up the kind of process of thinking and implementing in different cities?
Well, it will be both, but I think in this project, if you really are logic with the origin of the project, it's also up to the young people to decide how they see that, how do they see scaling in their city, and to discuss really with their city like how do we feel like this is scaling up, how do we see that we learn from our first experiences. So I would be a bit cautious to say like there's a kind of master plan or a kind of method how to scale up, but it's surely about strengthening the capacity of both youth organizations and local authorities to work together more, also in their own field, to do a better job, like to think about, okay, these spaces, we should not see them as leftover space, but really these are central, super important spaces that become places for young people. And also, I think then what will be interesting now is that the cities, of course, they have been, and the youth organizations have been concentrating on their own city, but now they also are part of a network. So you will see other focus teams in the other cities. So there can also be like an inspiration. Because when I spoke about Bandung, I think it's not like generalizing, but it could be like a project that is a bit like identifying what's typical strength of like what you can do in an Asian city that is high rise, very dense. But whereas you see in Envigado, I would say there's much more like a focus on social safety. So to work also not things that are so directly like translated into space, but to also really work around trust and participation and things that are rather invisible. So I think this experiences also will be inspiring between the cities. And we have a global convening, actually. That's also interesting to tell. We have a global convening in November coming up. And that will be the first time that all the people come together. Now, coming together will be virtually, because we are testing new approaches, of course, cautious about the climate agenda and not bringing people all together. It would be very costly. It's not climate friendly. And so we are now developing a virtual convening, but with VR, like a virtual reality, to try to bring everyone to the different atmospheres of Bandung in Indonesia and in Envigado in Colombia. So we really can have a full experience and we can discuss with each other on this definition of safety in cities and how we are developing strategies and common agendas in different parts of the world.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting, no?
Yes, like to it's going to be very, some, very interesting.
Yeah. And Jens, you worked, like, let's say, on the program of UNICEF, now you're working on this program. For us urban planners, there are a lot of different handbooks, programs, methods, and so on. Which one should we focus on?
Yeah. When I made the handbook of UNICEF, the first thing I realized when you start analyzing, there's a lot of handbooks. And I think making the handbook or making a handbook or using a handbook, it's also giving you mostly like orientation or comfort, like that you have a kind of roadmap, like in that in the, on that roadmap you might be have you need also comfort, like that you can fall back on tools or things that you can just get inspired to, and that you feel like, okay, these are things that have been tested by others. I think that's most important. I think for urban planners, and I, that's then coming back more to the towards our classic, I would say our classic technical expertise, is that we have to use the strength of translating things into design principles that are also sometimes leading to norms and standards or regulations, to really try to use that level of what is also a part of scaling, that you also you need to try to embed it into legislation. Because in a way, urban planners, mostly we work for the public good. We work for the public authorities, even if we work in firms like you and me, you know, like mostly our work is for public authorities. So you think as a public authority. So you think about like, how can this not be just like a one-off or something that depends on someone's
interest or
like you want to embed it into regulations and policies.
And so tell me, like, let's say if I'm an SCT authority, you know, and I see in front of me there are a lot of networks, handbooks, initiatives, open calls, how should I think and which direction should I take, which handbook should I follow, and so on? Do you have like a guide or an advice?
Well, I would not stick to one handbook. I think it's good to have like repositories. Like for example, the Child Friendly Cities Initiative of UNICEF has a very nice repository of a lot of great books. It's also something we are exploring with the S2 Cities. You know, like there is already like material available. I think it's more about like you see also every, it depends also like every city might feel the comfort to develop their own handbooks because it's in specific language, it's talking about specific context. So it's very difficult to say like which one you should choose. I think what's important is to if you're looking at placemaking, is to look at guidance that builds the bridges a lot. I think that really makes a connection with the field that is not just about the technical aspects, you know, like how to design. Okay, you also need to, but for example, the handbook in, that I made for UNICEF, I tried to work a lot on the connection with what actually urban design and planning means to get results in better health, better safety, youth empowerment, and to really make this connection and to also have like best practices that are really focusing on that. So I think it was I think it's a good book if you want to get inspired, like what can I do actually for children, or maybe I'm already doing a lot for children, but I want to more emphasize that. And then there was a lot of other books that came out. Street for Kids, for example, it's really a great book that really focuses on streets. And that also is not like only technical, but also like inspiring. It also talks about methodology, how to work with children and their caretakers, how to get them involved. So I think that's very important to find books that make these links between the technical aspects, but also about the process, or how do you work with data, and that it's not just about the spatial or the physical result, but also about the process and the results that you want to achieve.
Mm-hmm. And we usually say you can do this, you can try this, you use follow this handbook and so on, like more about doing stuff. I want to reverse the question and say, what should we stop doing as planners?
that's something you never write in books because you don't want to you know, like make a list of shame of things that we shouldn't do, and urban planners have done so many bad things, so there's a lot of literature about that. But for example, one of the things I found really striking, I think it would be good that all the urban planners and engineers and mobility experts that listen to you and, and me, we should really say everywhere in every city that like a pedestrian bridge over a busy road is really, really a bad solution, and that it will only increase road unsafety. It's absolutely unfair because most of the people cannot use the bridge. It will be only healthy people who can use it. Nobody with a wheelchair, nobody with a pram, nobody who is disabled. And it only increases the specialization of car-oriented transport in cities. And I think that's still like one of the major things that we are dealing with. And that's where really thinking as a child, like what a child needs in a city is so important, that you can actually make the case for this, like no pedestrian bridge, just from a children's perspective.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. More things that we should stop do.
I think it's also what we should also stop doing, I think, is not completely. I think we have to stop designing spaces only for kids. I think this focus on like you have like a playground, for example, and that is really like something that is just put there as an item. Like we have to stop like the item design that is just like a very, very direct answer on a specific need that was defined. It's something that is not actually fostering exchange between generations, also not between kids. It's also not actually sensitizing the everyone who uses the city, that children are there and they should be everywhere. So I think that's something that we should stop doing also. And that's also for other aspects, not only about playgrounds. We often do that, eh? Like it's the zoning plan attitude on the design level. Maybe exactly, zoning like has a sense on a larger scale, but then also like zoning within a public space is something that has to be very nuanced. Like you need to have zones, but there you also have to all the interesting transitions between the zones or the boundaries where you accumulate interaction, and not like distinguishing or making it impossible.
Yeah, as you mentioned, like now we shouldn't take the zoning principles or way of programming into the very, very, very small scale, as you say, because then we kill the space.
Yeah.
We, of course, we still, when we urban design, we still have to have to like different functions in the public space, but we shouldn't like really, how to say, over killing it and still have this transition or from this to this program or from this activity to this activity.
Yeah, I liked about the ones that really start the whole placemaking movement, the PPS. What I liked is this idea of the power of 10. A lot, and that you feel like you should actually have a space in a city and you can do 10 things there. And it's not me expert saying the 10 things. Everybody could think of like, okay, yeah, there's 10 things and I see it happening. There's 10 hours, maybe 20 things happening. That's actually what the result of design should be, that it allows to at least have 10 things happening, that everybody can define itself the 10 things that are happening there.
Yeah. And two questions before we go to the next part of the episode, which is going to be more about you, Jens. These two questions, one is, what skills should we as planners or city authorities learn or develop in order to plan and design more child-friendly cities?
So I would say like if the one thing is, of course, to be a good designer, but I would say like that's
per something default.
We should be. And then the challenge is like, how do you not communicate this, but actually how do you dare to go into professional environments of people that don't do design, but to identify that, first of all, what if they want to achieve results, that they need to think about space, and that you can be very quick into working with them, convincing them to look at this as an item, as a dimension in their work. So I think it's very important that you actually are able to be an expert in a field that is not in your comfort zone. I think it's very important. Why I say that, because we're also still very few, like there's a lack of urban planners. I mean, not in Europe, but in general, there's a lack of urban planners. And so you have to actually be able to work with other professionals that can really strengthen this focus on the quality of the built environment, nature, climate, etc. You asked me for a second thing. I already mentioned it briefly. I think what often is our weakness is that we are not easy in speaking about evidence and data. We are sometimes sitting on a pile of data, and we work with GIS and you know, we could say numbers about the space itself, but try to work also with data and evidence that is resonating exactly in this environment of other experts that is interesting for them, and to also again make the case, but also be able to monitor some things like what has been the success of this. For example, we did a really nice public space in Brussels. It's really, and you feel like it works super well. It's not just because of us, it's really because we had a very good public client and like park manager. But it would be have been so great that at that moment when the design was happening, that we should have been more like identifying and quantifying somehow, like, what's the situation now? What's the situation now? So we could really use these numbers of, like, there's more people using it, more variations in time, a differentiation of groups that are coming there. So that could be very interesting. Also from a research perspective, of course,
exactly.
But also just to be able to be more convinced into new projects to do it in a specific way.
Yeah. And the second question is, what is the next step for the program?
So, well, the global convening is going to be very important because it's the first time that a lot of cities will see from each other and a lot of young people will see from each other what they've been doing. So that's going to be a very interesting learning moment. And of course, that's going to be also a moment then to evaluate like this first 2 years. So I cannot be very precise like what's going to happen. So the objective is that the program grows and there's going to be a new call for new cities. There's going to be also efforts to actually strengthen the learning, the peer-to-peer learning between cities and youth organizations. And I believe that there's going to be this question coming back, like, how do you fund, how do you find more resources, whether it's brains, whether it's money to build things, whether it's time for people to be more involved into this project.
Interesting. I'm looking really forward to follow, and please later send me like some links you think interesting for our listeners.
I'll certainly do.
Yeah. And now we are in the second part of this episode, which is going to be more about you. And tell me what motivates you to do what you do, like what gives you energy to continue working in this field?
Well, I think like a lot of people that work on urban design and urban planning, it's a kind of passion. I think it's your work, but it's also like you are someone who probably likes to walk around, and as much as you like to see the people in the city, you also look at a city as a feature, as an urban landscape and the buildings and everything that's happening as something that's very dynamic. And I think also like nowadays you see more and more that this, as I said in the beginning, like this this challenge to achieve like global goals and to commit to and to really get to the Paris Agreement, which unfortunately becomes very difficult, and climate adaptation and all the, you see like space is so important. So we really, in Flanders, for example, we have said like there has to be a beton stop. This is a Dutch word, but I think you can understand what it is about. Like, and there should be like a stop to continue doing greenfield development. And I think everybody somehow in Europe is trying to deal with this. It's very difficult. You feel like it's super difficult. And you also actually at the same time, you see like that other parts of the world, like especially in Asia, but also in West Africa, there's such a huge urbanization now still happening where you cannot say there's going to be baton stop. I mean, you cannot do that. You have more and more people going to cities, and so you need to work that. So I think urban design and urban planning is only getting more important as a kind of foundation of solutions in climate, in health. So I find that very interesting to see that although we are not really seen as a major solution, because urban planning is also something that's everywhere. It's a kind of broad policy area. It's not a sector on its own, because you want to work with a lot of sectors. It's, I would say, like it's challenging, and also always to try to make the case for urban planning. If you work in a city in Europe, you probably don't have to make the case for urban planning. You might say, okay, there's assignments and there's a department of urban planning, but there's on the global on the global level, you feel like it's very, very challenging still to make the case for urban planning. So that's something that I like a lot to try to do that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And let's say 100 years from now, if people, I don't know if I should say Google, I don't know if Google gonna exist, but let's say when people see your name, what they will read about you?
I would say it's not so important today, but that's a good. I have no idea what would they read about me. Yeah, probably it will be something about someone who has done a program with built environment and communities or young people. Mm. That's, I hope that would be somehow still the digital footprint in 1 year or 100 years.
If you choose, or if you have the possibility to choose another profession, what will you like to do? Which profession would you like to work with?
I've always liked to see how doctors work. I think being a doctor could be very, very, very satisfying, very motivating. It's also like a challenging job. I sometimes speak with doctors and they're also depending on the public system, whether they're, you know, like well-resourced or not. But they really, it's really about people that they care. It's also like something that's very important. Everyone, you know, like it's the typical, I think, also joke in families. Like it's very interesting to in your family to have a doctor. You can call somewhere when there's an issue, but they're never gonna call the urban planner. You know,
that's the same here. Like I have two sisters, one brother. They are three doctors. You know, and like all the talks and discussions. It's about this health and medicine and so on.
Yeah.
No one is talking about long-term planning.
Urban planners sometimes, I think we make the mistake to be a bit very far from daily lives of people sometimes.
This is also
very technical, but we could say like, I think in COVID, maybe it came back a bit to say like, okay, the social distance is actually about physical distancing. So you need space in cities and it would be good to have more parks. And then suddenly there was a kind of re-acknowledgement that taking care of the health of cities is very important. Mm-hmm.
I think it's because also like our profession dealing with something like in the very long, long, long term is nothing like you see here and now. So that's why maybe people are not really interested in. So they are interested, but not in the same level as like if you talk about this product or like health that a doctor can contribute to and immediately something like this. I think it's because of this, like we have a long, long term of producing something.
Yeah, but then also like sometimes you can be involved into a public space design project that goes quite quick. Of course,
that's true.
It takes
true.
2 years, but then you see the effects also.
The result,
yeah.
Interesting. So now in the last part of the episode, three questions. And the first one is about you giving a message to yourself, but it's like this. The 70 plus years old Jens giving a message to Jens now. So what is the message going to be?
I didn't think about this. I think, I hope that others also came up with cliche answers. I think really spent you should have spent, or I would say like spend more time with younger people, younger professionals, to coach them, to give them comfort, to also admit that you don't know and that you might also have failed, because in a way our generation is also failing on a lot of things that we should have known already 40 years ago, and we somehow knew all the solutions. So I think it's a lot about trying to then at least give newer generations the comfort and to inspire them and to say what they have to do and not do. And so that would be a message to myself, to spend more time even on that, because often you're still like in that perspective that you're self-learning and developing. But I think it's also very important to work with others and to feel like you're learning from them, and they might also learn from you, and to really be much more thoughtful about it, and to also enjoy the time when that happens. Was it you wanted two messages?
This is was a message to you.
Okay.
One message, and exactly, and now three messages to all our listeners.
But so first of all, I would say I think space is important. So really to take care of it. As a tool to find solutions concerning climate change, health, mental health, physical health of all of us. I think that's very important to really take space as a very important value that brings people also together. Secondly, I would say build communities on a neighborhood level. Is very important, and so it's also towards cities to say, like, cities are very important, that's true, and you feel like they're more and more getting weight and attention on the global level, but also don't forget then that a city, you really have to go down to the neighborhood level, because that's where innovation starts, that's where change starts, that's where communities really connect to. Because cities also are becoming bigger and more complex, so I think neighborhoods are very important as a level. And then thirdly, I would say I think everything that is around nature-based solutions will be very, very important, because we have to really work with a minimum of resources. We really have to understand what nature gives us as solutions, to see it as an ecosystem that allows us to really manage water, manage health, manage food, manage air, clean air. And I think, of course, that's something that's now very, very much on the radar, but I think we have to emphasize that it's really not it's not a fashion. It's really like it's really the point where we have to go to start from to find scalable and impactful nature-based solutions for all the challenges that we see.
Yes. Awesome. And thank you so much, Jens, for giving your time to this episode, for recording this episode. And as I mentioned, I'm a very big fan of your work and looking forward to follow your journey as well.
Looking forward to follow yours too. And I'm looking forward to the podcast.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.